Hello, I'm Jonathan Odom, and I'm one of the military professors here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies. Today, I'm going to be discussing for a few minutes the role of international law in countering terrorism. A little background about myself, I've been a Navy lawyer in the U.S. Navy for over 20 years. During those 20 years, I've been a prosecutor. I've also deployed for counterinsurgency operations. I've been involved in writing maritime security strategies, including those that counter terrorism, and I've also been involved in negotiating agreements and helping to fight the threat of terrorism. So today is not intended to be a deep dive lecture on the role of international law, but rather to provide you with an overview of the ways in which we can use collectively international law in countering this threat. Now, here you see the six objectives of my brief presentation. First, we will discuss the conceptual roles of law in addressing this matter. Then we will talk about how international law does and does not define terrorism. Third, I'll explain the basis under international law for nations to counter terrorism. Then we will highlight some of the significant limits under international law in how a nation can counter terrorism. Fifth, I'll identify a number of existing international agreements that serve this role. And lastly, I'll highlight some potential ways in which international law might help to counter this threat in the future. First, with the objective number one of discussing the conceptual role of law in addressing these security matters, it's important to understand that international law, in many ways, just like domestic law, serves two roles. On the one hand, there's the normative role of law, and secondly, there is the instrumental role of law. Well, let me explain those. Sometimes you will hear leaders of governments and militaries use certain catchphrases to describe what I would say is the normative role of law. These include rule of law, a rules-based approach, or international law, rules, standards, and norms. At the same time, the law can serve another role. It can serve what I call an instrumental role. And that is, you'll hear sometimes leaders use phrases such as rule by law, or lawfare, or legal warfare, or last, legal policy. Lawfare and legal warfare have been defined by academics and some governments by the use of law as a weapon of warfare. And legal policy might sound like an oxymoron, but it's talking about, are there new laws that a nation needs to enact? They should enact those. Therefore, it's a policy matter in deciding whether to enact new laws, such as those that establish additional crimes within that nation's laws. So, from a visual perspective, or a conceptual perspective, the way that I distinguish these two types of roles are: the normative approach is like a ruler. That is, you can apply that ruler to a certain item and measure it. It is a standard measurement, and you can determine, yes, this fits within that restriction, or it does not. In contrast, the instrumental role of law could be best described or conceptualized as any other tool. That is, that item, that problem is a screw, therefore I use a screwdriver. That item or that problem is a nail, so therefore I use a hammer. So essentially the instrumental view is trying to figure out what the right instrument or tool to achieve the objective. Now these two theories on the role of law apply to a number of security matters, but they also specifically apply to the problem at hand, and that is how to effectively counter the threat of terrorism. Which brings us to objective number two, and that is, how does international law define terrorism? The reality is, as you will hear, a number of academic definitions of terrorism, but there is no universal definition. Moreover, there's no universal definition reflected in one single international treaty or convention. Instead, you'll find a number of the treaties governing matters involving terrorism as providing some additional granularity of what terrorism might be in particular instances. Here you see language from four different treaties out of the current 16 treaties involving countering terrorism. The two on the left you see here, they describe activities that are intended or calculated to provide a state of terror in the general population or in a group of persons or particular persons. That definition, in my opinion, is not necessarily helpful because it's kind of circuitous. When you say provide a state of terror, that kind of begs the question as to isn't that what terrorism is? In contrast, the definitions you see over on the right are a bit more helpful and a bit more detailed. So you see an act intended to cause death or serious bodily harm to a civilian when the purpose of the act is to intimidate a population or to compel a government or an international organization to do or abstain from doing any act. So while these are not universal definitions, they do in fact provide some granularity or some detail that has been a consensus reached by multiple nations as they negotiated these treaties. Our third objective is to highlight the basis under international law in which states may counter terrorism. There are several justifications or legal bases to do so. First and foremost, think of it from a domestic context, and that is, we see here in the UN Charter, it identifies that the UN Charter is not intended to govern matters which are essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of any state. So what that means is, if a nation enacts a law to counter terrorism, however that nation defines terrorism, then that's within the domestic jurisdiction of that nation in enforcing that law within its sovereign borders. But what happens if the threat of terrorism or an act of terrorism transcends borders? It crosses over borders from one sovereign state to another state. Well, what happens then? What is the justification, if at all, for using some sort of force or other action to counter that threat? You see here, UN Security Council Resolution 1546 from 2003, which is one of a handful of UN Security Council resolutions that focus on the issue of terrorism and countering terrorism more generally. In this resolution, you see that it says states must bring to justice those that have been involved in terrorist acts. They must do so in accordance with international law, and in particular, in bringing to justice, they either extradite or prosecute. And this is a phrase that you will find in a number of the international treaties governing terrorism. So, first of all, bringing to justice either means to extradite or prosecute. That is, indecision is not an option. Nations must decide they're going to prosecute, pursue prosecution for these individuals that are suspected of the activity, or if they don't prosecute, then they have a responsibility to extradite those individuals to another nation that does have such jurisdiction. What's also important to note in this provision is that nations must do this in accordance with international law. This brings me back to my first point about the two roles of law, one of which is normative. So any way in which the country is seeking to bring terrorists to justice, they must do so in accordance with international law. Here you see from the UN Charter a situation of what happens when nations are receiving a terrorist threat or they've been attacked by terrorists, then may they use force against those individuals responsible if they are located in another nation's sovereign territory. The general rule in the post-World War II rules-based order can be found in Article 2.4 in the UN Charter, in which it says that nations will refrain from use of force against any state. Now, that's the general rule. There are a handful of exceptions to that general rule. One of the exceptions is when the UN Security Council has authorized the use of force. A second exception that also exists is found here in Article 51 of the UN Charter. Specifically, Article 51 says that it is an inherent right of self-defense that every nation has. It's one that existed before the UN Charter was finalized in the mid-1940s. It's one that every nation has. And it's a right that's both collective and individual in nature. That is, every nation has the individual right of self-defense. Additionally, there's a potential collective right of self-defense. So, for example, in the context of terrorism and countering terrorism, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in 2001, right after the September 11th attacks, invoked Article 5 of the NATO Treaty for the first time in its history, in which it said that that attack upon the United States was an attack upon the NATO countries collectively. And so therefore, a number of NATO countries came to the aid of the United States, and many of the activities in which those countries have engaged thereafter in countering terrorism, whether it be with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, have been under the justification of Article 51 of the UN Charter. What we also see in this provision of the Article 51 is an armed attack against a member. This right is triggered by an armed attack against a member. Note that it says armed attack. It does not say an attack by a state. So therefore, it was deliberately broad in the context of this right, in that a terrorist organization that is not necessarily a state actor may trigger this right of self-defense. For example, the September 11th attacks in 2001, those triggered because of the magnitude and scale, using language from the International Court of Justice in previous cases, the scope and effect of that attack was more than just a law enforcement action. And therefore, it triggered more than just law enforcement measures, but it triggered this individual right of self-defense. The more difficult question is what happens when a nation receives a terrorist attack or is under threat of a terrorist attack, and the origins of that attack are from within the borders of another nation. Can the victim state use force or take other action within the borders of that second state? Well, we see here in this declaration from 1994 by the UN General Assembly, it says nations have an obligation to refrain from taking direct part in terrorist activities, but also refraining from acquiescing in or encouraging activities within their territories directed toward the commission of such terrorist acts. More recently, in the UN Security Council Resolution 1373 from 2001, in the weeks after the 9/11 attack, the Security Council said that it decides that nations must prevent those from using their territory against other nations in terrorist attacks. So here again, not acquiescing, also not preventing, the obligation to prevent. Which brings us to this question, ultimately, what happens if a state is unable or unwilling to prevent its territory from being used by terrorists to attack a second state? What right does that victim state have in that situation to go across the border and take action? Clearly, the desire under the UN Charter is to resolve disputes by peaceful means. Therefore, options to include, on the one hand, raising the issue bilaterally with that first state, or alternatively, raising the matter before the UN Security Council, or engaging other nations to take economic action sanctions against that first state. But what happens if all of those measures don't succeed? What if that second state is unable or willing to prevent the terrorists from using its sovereign territory? Clearly, as a nation, it has sovereign borders, it has sovereign territory, it has jurisdiction over matters within its territory. But what happens if it desires to not effectively exercise that jurisdiction, or it's incapable of doing so? Some nations believe in that situation, the victim state would be allowed to go into that other nation for the limited purpose of taking action against that terrorist group. But that perspective is not shared by all nations. Which brings us to objective four, and that is, assuming that nations are justified in taking action to counter terrorism, what may they do? Well, it depends. Why? Because there are other limitations under international law that govern the behavior of states in such situations. You see here, once again, from UN Security Council Resolution 1373, that calls upon all states to take appropriate measures. What kind of measures? Measures that are in conformity with national and international law. What are those measures, or what are those parameters? Well, here are just four examples of other bodies of law that set the parameters of lawful behavior. First, humanitarian law, that is sometimes known as the law of war or the law of armed conflict. And that is the body of international law that governs how nations may use force during an armed conflict, whether it's an international armed conflict or a non-international armed conflict, that is a civil war. In those rules, there are parameters for who may be targeted. There are parameters for how individuals, if they've been captured in the battle space and been detained, how they may be treated. There are rules on what type of weapon systems may be allowed. And there are a number of other categories. But those are some of the common principles reflected in humanitarian law. But there are other bodies of international law that might apply as well. For example, in the maritime context, encountering maritime terrorism, we must follow the law of the sea, as reflected in the 1982 Law of the Sea Convention. That body of law recognizes that the primacy of jurisdiction usually falls upon the flag state. That is, whatever nation that vessel has been registered under, that nation has the primary responsibility to enforce its laws against that vessel. But there can be exceptions, such as when that vessel pulls into a foreign port, then the port state also has jurisdiction over non-government vessels. It would not have jurisdiction over, for example, a sovereign immune warship. Another body of law involves the human rights law. This is a body of law separate and distinct from humanitarian law. It's focused not during armed conflict, but rather existing rights that apply even in times of peace. This body of law can include things like preserving basic human rights, political rights. It can also be reflected in the torture treaty, Convention Against Torture, and lays out what may or may not be done to a detainee. In addition, fourth and finally, is refugee law. There is a body of law, international refugee law, which is reflected in two conventions, one from the 1950s and another from the 1960s. So one of the common incidents is when individuals are fleeing from one nation to another nation, such as a mass migration during an armed conflict, and if there are potential terrorists hidden among those individuals that are migrating. In that situation, the body of international refugee law would say when those individuals may be admitted into the state, what types of rights they may be had, and whether they may be returned to the nation of origin. In short, all of these bodies of law might be triggered, might apply in a situation involving efforts by a state to counter terrorism. Our fifth objective is to identify some of the existing instruments that a nation can leverage to effectively counter terrorism. Now, when we say instruments, we mean treaties and international conventions. Really, there are two categories of treaties that we need to be mindful of. That is, there are the regional treaties, and then there are what I call the substantive treaties. The regional treaties include ones that involve bilateral, multilateral arrangements and agreements to prevent and suppress terrorist attacks. That is, where nations are working together, where they are cooperating to counter a common threat. We also see here from another UN Security Council resolution that nations are called upon to become a party to all relevant international conventions and protocols relating to terrorism. So when we say the first category of regional agreements to counter terrorism, we see here a map of the world that provides the existing regional agreements. Each of these have certain characteristics that are unique to that particular region, but at the same time they also have other common elements, such as specific ways in which nations can cooperate, including the sharing of intelligence, the working together to do cooperative training programs in countering terrorism, developing technology together to counter potential threats, such as chemical weapons, biological weapons, and nuclear weapons and radiological devices. And what I would say is, in a personal opinion, when I look at all of these regional agreements, probably the best model might be the ASEAN Convention on Countering Terrorism, which is from 2007. And part of that may be from the fact that it's the latest in time in all of these, and so it borrowed some ideas and methodologies from the other agreements and brought them all into one strong agreement. But this is just the first category. Then there is what I refer to as the substantive treaties on countering terrorism. But before we look at the list of those agreements, we need to recognize that a number of those agreements didn't just happen in a vacuum, but rather they happened, they were developed, they were finalized in response to some prior terrorist threat or action. So during the mid-80s, there was a wave of aircraft, commercial airline hijackings in which individuals were hijacked by terrorists. They were hijacked for the purpose of potential ransom or for demanding a release of prisoners in another state. And so as a result, there were treaties that were developed to counter that threat. But what we realized from that treaty and those treaties was that they didn't envision a situation where terrorists, instead of using a hijacking for the purpose of exchanging money or exchanging for prisoners, but rather to actually use the aircraft as a weapon in itself, such as happened on September 11th, 2001. Another example was the hijacking of the Achille Lauro in the Mediterranean, which was a commercial cruise ship. And in that situation, a U.S. national, Leon Klinghoffer, was killed by the terrorists. And one of the results of this was a recognition that in some situations on the high seas, nations needed to find ways to work together to counter this threat that might transcend borders along the high seas. So here we have the existing 16 treaties governing countering terrorism. And I've taken them, and instead of arranging them in a chronological fashion, I have instead arranged them under what I call the five categories of efforts. And that is, you see here, countering terrorism that's directed at air transportation. There have been four treaties on that matter. Countering terrorism directed at maritime transportation. There have been essentially two treaties, but they have been updated most recently in 2005. You see countering terrorism directed at categories of persons. Specifically, there's one treaty dealing with the protection of diplomatic agents, individuals that work at embassies, for example. The fourth category is countering terrorism that's directed at nuclear material. And then finally, there's kind of a catch-all of countering specific tactics, that is, methods or means that terrorists have been using on a repeated basis, whether that is taking of hostages, the technological development of using plastic explosives that can sometimes evade detection systems, or targeting the profit, or the way in which terrorism is funded. And so nations working together to counter the financing of terrorism. What these treaties have in common is essentially these four elements. While they don't generally define the concept of terrorism, they instead define a particular type of terrorist violence as an offense. Then, they require the state parties, when they join that convention, to penalize that activity as a matter of criminal law under that domestic law of the nation. It then identifies certain bases under which a nation may establish jurisdiction over those offenses. And then lastly, and as I mentioned earlier, it puts an obligation on those member states to either extradite or proceed with prosecution. But the reality is we're always battling with terrorists that are trying to be smarter than these nations, who are trying to get one step above nations as they counter these threats. Which brings us to objective six, and that is, are those treaties sufficient, those 16 treaties, or do we need new additional agreements? Well, it depends. If we look at these examples of current trends of terrorist attacks just in the past 2 years, we see common things such as activities, attacks that are happening in entirely public places. We're seeing activities that are happening before you enter security at the airport. So while previous treaties might have regulated the activities once someone was beyond security checkpoints or they were actually in the plane, we see here in the Brussels attack from March 2016, the terrorist attack happened outside of security. Or you look at more recently, the use of a truck for the terrorist attack in Nice, France in July of 2016. So instead of the terrorists using that vehicle as an explosive device to kill more people, instead the vehicle itself was used as the weapon. Is there some way that nations should work better? Should there be additional treaties and conventions that address that type of tactic? Or is the law sufficient and what nations need to do is rely upon the existing treaties to cooperate better, and that is share more intelligence? That's always the question we need to be asking. So, when we look at, are there potential gaps in treaty law to counter terrorism? Ways to consider that is to think about the particular domains. We see that there are ample treaty law governing countering terrorism in the maritime context with the Suppression of Unlawful Acts at Sea Convention from 1988 and 2005, as well as the four treaties governing terrorism directed at air transportation. But potentially we need new treaties governing terrorism in other domains, such as the use of cyber as a channel for conducting terrorist attacks against, for example, critical infrastructure of a nation. In addition, we should consider whether there are additional treaties needed to protect categories of persons. We have the treaty that exists to protect diplomatic agents. We have bodies of international law that govern protecting innocent civilians. But the challenge here is that just as the terrorist knows what the law is, they know what the jurisdiction of nations are, and they don't ignore it, but rather they exploit it. And so therefore, the exact nature of the attack is sometimes directed at civilians because it creates more terror. So the reality is creating more offenses to protect innocent civilians under treaty law is not necessarily a solution. Are there additional target sets that need to be protected or because they are at risk? Maybe treaties governing critical infrastructure, because there are treaties governing protection against terrorist attacks against nuclear facilities, but maybe there need to be additional treaties. And then lastly, the unknown unknown. Are there unknown emerging tactics, or there been a pattern more recently of certain tactics employed by terrorists that need to be addressed by treaty law under those what we have now as 16 existing substantive treaties? That just provides an overview of the role that international law can provide in countering terrorism. By no means is it intended to be that the law is a solution to all our problems, but what we do know is that every solution that states pursue must conform with international law as well as the laws of that individual nation. I hope this has been helpful to you, and if you have any questions, please do not hesitate to contact us at the Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies. Thank you very much.